This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll continue the tradition of looking back on the year that is finishing. As we move ahead into this 13th season of Cadenza, it's still a worthy endeavor to glance over the shoulder. This past year was dominated by the creators of music, composers, over a third of the weeks devoted to these artists. Unlike in past years, we had very few weeks devoted to ensembles, especially string quartets that in past years were majorly represented, played a small role in the past year's overall guest list. This past year, we only had the Israeli-based New England Conservatory-trained Ariel Quartet, and the quartet that, since they were formed 20 years ago, has aimed to blur the style lines of music that a quartet can perform, the Ethel Quartet. We spoke with Brad Lubman and Lauren Radnofsky from the group dedicated to performing the newest music, the Ensemble Signal. We chatted with groups performing music from centuries back, from Boston Baroque and their founder and music director Martin Perlman, who was joined by their concertmaster Christina Day Martinson, to Frederick Renz, founder of Early Music New York and the umbrella organizations attached to this now 44-year-old establishment, keeping early music practice vibrant in New York City. You're listening to them perform a well-known Renaissance dance that we attach with words to the Christmas tide from their CD A Renaissance Christmas. Here he is talking about how to interpret this music from centuries back and make correct decisions about interpretation.
Well, I mean, there are treatises that pretty much outline how to articulate on a specific instrument. Dynamics, that's another story, although later in the 18th century, one started seeing fortes and piano signs, so you could always extrapolate back, assume that everybody knew to do those things, but then things became more regimented and more things got put into scores to guide you along the way. But, it boils down to musicality, and then the question is 18th century sense of musicality at all similar to 20th century musicality? Did they emphasize the bass more? Did they emphasize the treble more? Did they use vibrato? Did they not use vibrato? Again, informed imagination is the term that I
yeah,
my excuse.
One more ensemble was the Boston-based, Longy School of Music residency-based Neve Trio, Anna Williams, Mikhail Veselov, and Eri Nakamura. Their name, Neve, N-E-A-V-E, is odd, and here is Anna to tell the story of where it came from, followed by the trio performing the middle movement from Leonard Bernstein's little-known 1937 trio from the group's recording on the Chendos label called American Moments.
It's a Gaelic word. It happens to mean bright and radiant, but we had no idea of that when we chose it. In fact, we were told that post factum, and we were all like, oh no, people think that we chose this in a presumptuous way. No. So it was actually after a very meaningful experience we had in New Jersey, like you're saying, we got to know this community in New Jersey that we would play for, and this one audience member in particular, his name was Bruce, and he was someone for whom music just really meant the world. He was really emotive about it. It just really touched him very deeply, and he would talk to us about it after we would play, and ultimately he had an accident that left him paralyzed. So it was sort of a no-brainer for us at the time that, if he couldn't come to us, as he was so excited and willing to have done before his accident, we were, of course, going to go to him. So we started going to him, and we would play at his bedside, and it was really amazing because, we just were giving what we could of playing for him, the least we could do, and in return, he would tell us these really touching, intimate, beautiful stories about his life before he had this accident. He would talk about different adventures he had had, and he talked about his family, and most notably, he would talk about his daughter, whose name was Neve. And it was just sort of, I don't think he ever knew, but I think it's safe to say that, we felt like we got more out of the exchange than he could have ever known, maybe probably more than he could have. And it just sort of encapsulated how this music that we love, it has the potential to really connect people on such a profound level. So we wanted to honor him and that experience and to carry it with us going forward in whatever circumstances we might be in. So that's why he chose Niamh.
Okay, well, two questions. Did he know you chose Niamh before he passed?
I don't think he did. Okay. I think his daughter, who is currently living in Ireland, Niamh, she was made aware of it.
Okay.
We've yet to meet her. We would love to meet her. But, but yeah, so, and I think she spells her name the correct way, I would assume. So,
yes.
So she might question her spelling, which is fair.
The Human Voice didn't get a lot of coverage in 2018, but we did speak with Jan Eik Tulva and his wife, composer Helena Tulva. Jan Eik, the founder of the fascinating and wonderful Estonian-based choral ensemble Vox Clamantis that grew out of a performance tradition of singing Gregorian chant. Moving to conductors, we spoke with the great English musician Stephen Darlington, wrapping up 32 years leading the choir of Christ Church, Oxford. In the last months of 2017, I had a flurry of programs featuring European-born maestros now leading major American orchestras, and we finished that up earlier this year chatting with the Swiss-born flutist turned conductor, Thierry Fischer, who is music director of the Utah Symphony. We spent 2 weeks visiting with the Russian-born conductor, who also teaches and conducts here in the U.S., when he's not in front of his Siberian State Symphony Orchestra, Vladimir Landa. We also spent 2 weeks chatting with the music director and founder of the North Jersey-based Discovery Orchestra, Maestro George Mariner Mall, and the very different mission of that orchestra.
Yeah, the Philharmonic Orchestra of New Jersey had been founded as a freelance professional orchestra, like other professional orchestras in the area, in the city and out here in New Jersey. And we performed what people expected, normal symphonic concerts. And, you know, that started in 1987. However, even early in that orchestra's life, people began calling the orchestra and saying this: I don't know enough about classical music. Is there anything that you could recommend? So we got enough of these inquiries that the board said, you know, George, could you teach a course in music listening to adults? And I said, well, sure. Yeah. So we set up this, I don't know, 6-week course or 8-week course, whatever it was, every Wednesday night or every Monday night for an hour and a half. And I think 12 people took the first one, you know, back in 1991 or whatever it was.
It's a start.
It was a start. That's right. And of course, you know, as would have it, you know, by the year, I don't know, 2005, I was talking to maybe 3,000 people a year in various settings, yeah, you know, at the Art Center in Newark and through things that the orchestra set up. But it became popular and it began to grow. More and more people began to take it. And so the next thing that the board said was, could you do in a concert what you do in the course? And that caused us to give our first Discovery concert in Princeton, in Richardson Auditorium, on the Bach Brandenburg Concerto No. 4. And it was very successful. People liked it very much. And after that, I don't know, maybe a couple of years later, again, in one of these great visioning exercises that consultants put boards through,
yeah,
it was asked, you know, think of what you'd really like to do. You know, just the wildest ideas you can come up with. You know, we're putting them up on stick up paper on the wall, you know, and that sort of thing. And then and one of the things that went up was, make a television show out of a Discovery concert for public television, you know? And of course, everyone laughed when this came up. But then the consultant asked the board to prioritize all these crazy ideas on the wall. And the one that they liked the most was make a television show. So we committed ourselves at a certain point to somehow recording one of our Discovery concerts, which by then had become a regular feature of each season. We would do at least one Discovery concert during the season. And so they decided to record the Bach, and we did it at NJPAC and submitted it to American Public Television, and they loved it. And the rest was sort of history. And, yeah, you know, so we realized that we could reach a lot of people with these television programs, many more than we could reach just giving live performances here. So anyway, as fate would have it, as we progressed toward the year 2006, the board began to realize that maybe the most important thing that we could be doing was this work, as opposed to giving normal orchestral concerts. In other words, we looked around and said, look, you can go to the New Jersey Symphony concerts. You can go to the New York Philharmonic's concerts across the river. You can go to all of the visiting orchestra concerts that come in from Europe that are at Carnegie and in NJPAC and what have you. You know, there's no shortage of wonderful orchestral concerts to go to. However, there are not that many people teaching people how to listen to this music. So maybe we should just narrow focus. And we began saying, let's think about a total change. And so in 2006, it was scary because the board said, okay, we're going to change the name and we're never going to give a regular concert again. Uh-huh. We're only going to give Discovery concerts.
That's a huge quantum jump.
It was a big jump.
Yeah.
It was a big jump. And of course, now we're talking about making our fifth show for American Public Television in the fall of 2019.
Yeah. You know, awards, accolades, Emmy nominations later. And
yeah, it's amazing what happened. It's been a wild ride.
Maestro Mall has brought that gift to our airwaves and his inside music, which is in essence what he does with the Discovery Orchestra, providing his insight into a piece of music, allowing all of us to, in his words, listen better. Inside music can be heard each second and fourth Saturday of the month at 7:30 p.m. and is also available online as webcasts. Another maestro who also enjoys the singular status as the longest-running college university president in the country, as well as continuing as music director of the American Symphony Orchestra, Leon Botstein was our guest. He has led Bard College since the 1970s and started the famous Bard Festival, and also leads a group of extremely talented young musicians in The Orchestra Now, and that ensemble now has found a home here on the Classical Network and is part of our rotating Friday night lineup. Here he is talking about programming and widening our musical choices and opportunities through programming.
Well, your observation that a museum wouldn't survive by simply showing the same paintings or moving them around, that's true, and museums have fought that problem as well. I mean, there is the fact that there are some large percentage of the visitors to the Louvre who simply go to see the Mona Lisa.
Right.
So there is a little bit of a fight that the museums have themselves, and there's no problem in going to a museum and delighting in seeing those paintings that are always there. And that's fine, but the museum world is also a vital one that's showing contemporary paintings and reviving artists that have been unfairly forgotten and doing retrospectives and constantly questioning and reordering the history of art. And that's what we need to do in the concert hall, the symphonic and operatic concert hall in particular, or this operatic stage. The fact is that we are really behind, you know, we're lagging behind because, as you suggest, the management as well as the training of musicians is wildly obsessed by a kind of masterpiece syndrome, that in music we ask a question which other art forms never ask. No one reads a new novel, and the first thing they say, well, it's not War and Peace. No one says that. No one puts a book down and says, well, I'll reread War and Peace for the 15th time because no novel measures up to it. The people don't do that. People don't look at art and say, well, you know, it's not The Last Supper. It's not Guernica, or it's whatever, you know, iconic painting they consider to be a masterpiece. And so we are caught in a very bizarre narrowing of the repertoire with constant repetition. And that is an insult to the history of our own art form. So the way you tell the story of the past defines who you are in the present and future. The way we tell the story of the Republic of America, the way we tell the story of the history of France, the way people tell their stories gives you a clue, the way they construct history. And if you falsify history, you condemn the present and future to not the most salutary or optimistic future and present. So we're telling lies, frankly, about our own past. We're hiding part of our own past. We're ignoring part of our own past at our peril. So music, opera, symphonic music, is filled with repertoire that is fabulous, terrific, engaging, arresting, memorable, which we never play.
Which we never play.
And your question is, how do you find it? Well, returning to an earlier question you asked, early on I realized that the key to that was scholarship. Was spending time looking at history and looking at works from the past that were terrific, that had a response, and that disappeared. Composers that disappeared, works that disappeared. And it turns out that systematic research in that led to clues and discoveries that were waiting to be discovered, and that you were simply opening the treasure chest, if you will, the vaults of our own history that had a real provenance, works that were great. Give you an example. The Swiss composer, Ottmar Schoeck, not a name known to most concert goers, the leading composer of the 20th century in Switzerland.
Right.
He wrote a song cycle called Buried Alive, based on the poems of Gottfried Keller, the Swiss writer who wrote a masterpiece, a novel called The Green Henry. Now, who thought that this song cycle for baritone was the greatest piece of his lifetime? None other than James Joyce. Now, if James Joyce thought this was the greatest piece and motivated him after he heard it on the radio to pay a visit to the composer, that's enough to inspire me to take a look at the piece. The great opera by Paul Dukas, Ariane Barbleu. Paul Dukas is known only for The Sorcerer's Apprentice. essentially.
Right.
So now, who thought this was a great opera? Schoenberg, Messiaen, Berg, Korngold. Now, when you read these individuals saying this is a masterpiece, it behooves you to take a look at it.
We'll leave the conductor realm here. If you ever wonder what the average orchestra musician thinks of the average conductor, here's a little levity, once again, from Maestro George Mariner Mall.
Here it is. Basically, we're at the opera house. And the good thing about this joke is it gets violas and conductors at the same time.
Okay.
As you know, conductors have lots of jokes about them too.
Sure.
So anyway, we're at the opera house, and the stage manager is peering through the curtain and realizes that he does not see the conductor in the pit. And it's like 2 minutes before curtain. And so he gets on the house phone and says to the people in the management, are any of the assistant conductors in the theater? Well, no. And he says, oh, I see. So now it's 1 minute before. So he looks down there. And of course, you know, all the players are in the pit, you know, playing their excerpts, you know, making all that racket down there. And so he yells down there, is there anybody down there who could conduct Tosca tonight? You know? And so this violist starts waving his bow and he says, I can do it from memory. You know, so he goes, get on the podium. So he puts the viola down and gets on the podium and conducts a brilliant performance of Tosca from memory. And the next night he comes to the opera and he sits down and his stand partner turns to him and says, where were you last night?
We had many talented instrumentalists on the program this past year, from A to almost Z. The young Chinese-born accordionist, Hanshi Wang. Two young cellists, the German Gabriel Schwalbe and the Israeli-born Amit Pellid, who is playing on Pablo Casals' cello given to him by Casals' widow. Here he is with the story of how that happened, followed by Amit playing some Bach from the solo cello suites on the Casals' cello.
Marta Casals, she is still alive, widow of Pablo Casals. She's in her 80s. She lives in Washington in front of the Kennedy Center that she used to run in the 80s. She also ran the Manhattan School of Music. She's a legend by herself, let's say it like this. And I became very good friends with somebody who knows her well. And he's much older than me, but sort of an amateur cellist. And I gave him a few lessons. We became friends. And he told me one day, you know, you should play for her. You should know her. Not for the cello, but just for the sake of knowing her. So, of course, I agreed. And I prepared a short program for her. And I went there with him. We went there and I played for her. I just came in and I started with Bach. I thought Bach, because of the connection to Casals, to play Bach would be the best thing to start with. And after the first movement, the prelude of the first suite, she stopped me and she said, you know, Amit, usually I shut my ears off when I hear a young artist, but I haven't done that when you play. And I was shocked. You know, I was like, wow. And I said, oh, thank you, Mrs. Casals. That's a great compliment. Thank you. It's really an honor. And she said, would you mind if I give you a few comments? And I said, no, by all means, please. Please do. And then she practically killed me. She went back to the first note, and then every single note she told me. Now, she was a great cellist herself. She was a student of Casals. She was around the greatest musicians of last century, all of them, including Rostropovich and, of course, Istomin, who became her husband,
right,
and many, many, many others. So every word she says is gold mine. And it was amazing. And then she said, you know what, play the second movement. So I did. And then it was the same deal. And the third, the whole suite. And then she said, play some Dvořák concerto, which is our most famous concerto. Now, I wasn't prepared for that, but of course I had to play. Otherwise, you know, she's a scary lady. You don't want to mess with her. And I played Brahms and I played Chopin. And after more than an hour, she said, you know what, let's have a glass of wine. So I didn't refuse. I sat on the couch next to her.
You still had no idea what was coming around the corner, right? You still didn't...
No, not at all.
All right, okay.
Just, you know, kind of relieved it was over in a way. And I sat next to her and our friend on another couch, our mutual friend, and she looks at me and she said, you know, you're a big guy. I'm 6'5".
Yeah.
And she says, and the maestro, as she refers to her late husband, the maestro, she says, and the maestro was not so tall, but if you have time, would you like to come to New York, to my apartment in New York, and try his cello? My answer was, of course I have time. And even then, I thought, you know, I'm the luckiest cellist on earth that I get to touch and smell this historic instrument. But that was it. I came to New York.
Right.
And she opened the door. I tried the cello. And it was like waking up an old person that was very peacefully asleep and didn't want to wake up. I played a few notes on it. not more than maybe 15 minutes, and she let me play on it. I was really in heaven because I touched the cello that defined my musicianship when I was 10 years old, listening to that tape cassette with Casals playing. And I was really in the sky. But after it was over, I thanked her, and I left, and I had a big smile on my face, and that was it. And our mutual friend said to me, you know, you should thank her, but not by email, because she's from an old generation. You should really write her a handwritten note. So I did. I wrote a letter, and I thanked her for the opportunity and for the chance to meet her and for the lesson and, of course, trying the cello, and it was really a dream come true. And then guess what? 2 weeks later, I get an email from her. and the email said that she's very thankful for my note and sincerity, and she would like to lend me this instrument so I can share it with the world, but also that I can find my own voice through it.
Right.
It was very interesting. Something that took me a few years to understand. That second sentence.
Our instrumentalist lineup was nearly all young artists of immense talent. However, we did visit with legendary clarinetist Stanley Drucker, now in his late 80s, who played over 10,000 concerts in his career, spent 61 years playing in the New York Philharmonic, 49 of those as principal clarinetist appointed to that post by Leonard Bernstein in 1960. Here he is remembering the good times.
I mean, was there a sense in those heady years, so many recordings going out, the touring and all that stuff, that... You were like riding a crest?
Oh, there's no question. You know, the tours were amazing. They were glamour tours. The recordings never stopped.
Right, yeah.
He did recording after recording. Not only the works that were being played, they were works that were, not played. Some of those were called junk sessions. You know, you recorded things like Dance Macabre. It wasn't in the concert that week, but...
you need the filler and...
But that was one of the things recorded, you know... There was a young concertmaster at the time who said to Lenny, you know, I've never played this piece before. And Lenny said, you know, I haven't never conducted this piece. And the assistant concertmaster said, you'll both love it.
Two very different guitarists were guests, the young acclaimed Frenchman Thibaut Garcia and the American guitarist and also founder of the very influential New Focus Recordings label, Dan LaPelle. British harpsichordist Christopher Lewis delighted us just a few weeks back, and we had a long line of pianists. The phenom young British artist Benjamin Grosvenor, a reappearance of the Croatian-born German pianist Anna Maria Markovina, who when last on Cadenza had just recorded a 26-CD set of the music of C.P.E. Bach and now is exploring the little known Anton Urschbruch from the end of the 19th century and was beginning a set of piano recordings of the music of Anton Bruckner. The Argentinian-born American pianist Miriam Conti was also a guest. We'll hear from her in a few minutes. American pianist Joanna Polk, who has done such laudable work throughout her career championing the music of American women composers. Vicky Chow, who's championing new music, especially in her role as pianist in the Bang on a Can All-Stars. The Latvian-born American pianist Eleanor Bindman, who paired up with past Cadenza guest Jenny Lynn to record Ms. Bindman's piano forehand arrangements of all six of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. Here they are performing the final movement of Brandenburg Concerto No. 2. Thank you. close out on the piano side, we had American Michael Adcock, who's a proponent of piano transcriptions and ragtime, and the wonderful and almost without peer piano duo of Greg Anderson and Elizabeth Joy Rowe. Check out any recording of the Anderson-Rowe duo, and you will not be disappointed. Rounding out our instrumentalists were young violinists, the German-born Augustin Hedelich, and from Norway, Eldbjørg Hemsing. We also chatted with the exciting American violinist who clashes the worlds of classical and bluegrass, Tessa Lark. As I mentioned at the top of the program, this year was heavily devoted to composers. All were American, save two. One of those, the British composer who began his career as a member of the King Singers and was in the U.S. celebrating the 50th anniversary of that incredible male choral group, Bob Chilcott. Young American composers such as Jeremy Gill and Tristan Perich were heard from, as well as established composers Jake Heggie, Patrick Zimmerli, who is a style blender known in the worlds of jazz as well as classical, and the Fritz Reiner Professor of Music Composition at Columbia University, composer and theorist Fred Laerdal. We also heard from one of the three composers who began the influential Bang on a Can, Michael Gordon. He formed Bang on a Can with past Cadenza guests, his wife Julia Wolf and David Lang. We talked to three of the six American composers who make up the wonderful collective known as Sleeping Giant, Robert Hohnstein, Christopher Cerrone, and Ted Hearn. Here in this year of the Me Too movement and continued spotlight on how women are treated in our society and trying to move forward in so many ways despite continued abuse, both verbal and physical, and cover-ups of these abuses which take us all the way up to the White House, here is Ted Hearn's work, which takes its texts from Love Letters by the Composer and from his grandfather, and the transcript of a rape trial. The work is called Consent.
I want to, 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 I want you, I want you, I want to, I want to.
I was thinking that it's really hard to meet.
We heard from three prominent women composers this year, one of America's preeminent composers of art song, Lori Laitman, the MIT-based composer Elena Ruhr, and the Yale-based composer Hannah Lash, who, in addition to being a composer, is also an accomplished harpist. Here are her thoughts on how the genders stand in the composing world.
Yeah, I mean, it is an issue still, and it's such a big topic. It's actually difficult to get into in a short amount of time.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I can say that my own perspective on this has been that, you know, the music that I connect to very deeply and the people that I consider to be my forebears are actually all male. And I think that to a certain extent, this has been perceived by people who know me as a bit problematic. But my response to that has been, it's not at all problematic. I have just as much claim to this music as you do. And if I feel like writing 16th century counterpoint, which did belong to men, let me appropriate it, and let me take it, and let me have it, because I can. And the same with any other type of music. And it doesn't mean that I'm perpetuating the social structures from which that music arose. In fact, I'm lifting it out of those social structures and giving it new life in a new social structure, which hopefully is more equitable.
Yeah.
We're at an interesting time right now because we're all very sensitive to this issue, so we're all thinking about it a lot. Mm. But yet, I don't think we have yet transcended the more difficult internalized aspects of sexism, which are very much ingrained in us. So, you know, girls are taught from a very young age to be probably more polite and deferential, for example, than their male friends are taught to be. You know, boys tend to raise their hands a lot more in class than girls do. So something like that, which, you know, seems as though it's a potentially relatively small issue which should be able to be surmounted, actually can become an enormous impediment and can almost sort of metastasize as one gets a bit older, you know. And it takes a great deal of self-conviction to be a composer. I think you have to be a bit of an egotist, honestly. I myself have found that, you know, the compartmentalization of self is tremendously important in that regard. I think I can talk a good game in terms of my own egotism in my artistic field when I can tell you quite honestly that I'm anything but in a personal sense.
Yeah. I spoke this past year with four composers, all in their 80s, all composing over six decades. David Del Tredici, who turned the classical world on its head in the 70s with his works inspired by the Alice in Wonderland stories and brought serious music back to tonality.
Well, yes, it was a surprise. I did not plan to change anything, but I was merely following my own fantasy about making these stories in Alice in Wonderland come to life. I wanted them to live, but I couldn't use any more for some reason. I didn't know, atonality. It didn't fit the Victorian wit, the whimsy, the charm. All of that was not atonal. So I did grasp for tonal chords and things I thought made it come to life. And in that process, little by little, I realized, I'm doing something that's wrong, quote-unquote wrong. Certainly, it was unthinkable to do such a thing. And I did it thus very cautiously. In the beginning, just a few chords, and then I got more and more. And finally, by coincidence, when I wrote Final Alice, the longest piece and the one with the most public exposure, it was also the one that had the most tonality.
Right.
In the earlier Alices, the tonality would sometimes be covered up by a scrim of wrong notes, so you kind of glimpse it as if from the past. But when I got to Final Alice, the wrong notes never came, so I was stuck with all this tonality. And then I was terrified and had a sort of nervous breakdown. I thought, I can't go on. I can't do this. My colleagues will think I'm crazy. But then I thought, this is what my instinct gives me. It gives me now tonics and dominants, so it used to give me minor sevenths, minor ninths. So I'm going to just go with it. Whatever the punishment is, I'll accept it.
Were you back at the time, had that much angst about what your colleagues would say? Was it really that kind of arena that, like...
Yes, because I didn't have a public. There's no such thing as a public. But I just had, you know, people who went to the concerts and my friends and who were all atonal. I just, you know, that was my judgment world, you might say.
But then validation, I think of the old Mozart quote, you know, like with Magic Flute, where he used to look like walking down the street and hearing the people hum the tunes as they walked past. I mean, you had people walking out of the house humming something that they just heard for the first time, which had not been done for many long time.
It seemed to have been an earworm, as they say.
Yeah, well, good. but then also, I mean, the Pulitzer, was that kind of saying, aha, you know, was that a moment where you said, okay.
Well, it was a great surprise that I would... with that style, to get a Pulitzer right away. It was a big leap for the Pulitzer Committee to give it to me, and it was certainly validation. Certainly made me, got me tenure, got me a better job, and with a bigger salary, so that was all very good.
As this all happened, I mean, we're still kind of in the arcing point of the Alice period. Did you hear from composers who were trying to hold on to some basis of tonality in their processes? Did you hear from them saying, thank you, or God bless you, or something like that?
As the years went on, I certainly did. People would say, I turned on the radio and I heard this weird piece. I thought, is this some Strauss opera I've never heard before? Right. But then it was too dissonant for that. So they did say they couldn't believe that something like this existed, and that therefore they could re-embrace tonality if they'd given it up, which many of us had. The reason it was so exciting to do dissonance, it was really a wonderful, thrilling thing. We were coming from a world of Copland and Barber and Menotti, kind of the so-called wholesome Americana, which was wonderful in its own right, but it was not something we wanted to continue. And then when this sort of green fog from Europe came, called Schoenberg, you know, Berg and Webern, it was thrilling to be enveloped in this strange new mist. And so I certainly got involved in it, and I went to Princeton, which was a hotbed of advanced thought. And I wrote a number of pieces, Joyce pieces, that were quite atonal. But but I got tired of it and wanted to go somewhere else. Thus, the text of Alice in Wonderland appealed to me, because without my realizing it, I think my instinct thought that if you get involved in this, it's going to change the way you write, because it's a completely different world. You're going to have to find the musical equivalent of that new world.
We also spoke with Gordon Getty, a longtime composer, despite being born into and having at one point in his life to take care of the finances of one of the world's richest family dynasties.
Well, I knew I was a composer from my earliest memories. I knew that my family had wealth maybe 10 years later. I guess there are people that decide that they want to be composers, but that isn't the way it should work. You're a composer whether you like it or not, and you sit down and write it if you want to, mm-hmm. but you're a composer if you are, if you're born that way.
If you're a creator, you're a creator. That's
yeah. So the money, but the genius of my father left me a lot of dough, left me the means to support other people's music and my own. I'm not too proud to have paid for some of my own performances. Incidentally, so did Beethoven, mm-hmm. who was born to moderate wealth. But I pay for other people's performances too. And the foundations I support, most of them, hundreds and hundreds, most of them couldn't do my music because a lot of them don't perform music, or they teach or something, or I haven't written genres of music that they could perform. It's not about rewarding those who perform my music. I hope that has nothing to do with who I give to.
But I think the fact is just that if the die was recast and music was pulled out of your life, things would have been a lot different, and it seems, from what you've said, in a more dire way, that you would have had to deal with the music was a way for you to pull back and live almost a parallel life. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you
well,
know.
I'll say one thing is that if I had to make a living as a composer, holy mackerel! Does anyone make a living as a classical composer?
Brian Carter did, but he.
John Adams, close friend of mine, tells me that
he's close. He's close. But
yeah,
not completely.
But close, bless his heart. Close friend, by the way.
No, teaching.
Even they teach,
the cards,
they you know. Teach or they conduct.
Yeah, it's in the cards. It's just it is.
Yeah. Would I compose more if I had less things to do on the side? I don't know.
We also spent some time with composer, arranger, French hornist, jazz performer, and musician who, along with Jack Kerouac, began the whole beat poetry movement back in the late 1950s, a musician who has literally worked and performed with everyone who's everyone across his long career, David Amram.
You mentioned all these jazz greats, and you don't have to comment on this, but I think our listeners should hear that a lot of these great jazz artists you worked with and knew were great fans of classical composers.
Yeah,
Charlie Parker turned you on to Frederick Delius, and no one could ever think that up.
No, I was shocked. About 3 a.m, he said, "Man, check out Frederick Delius." He said, "Not just the Cuckoo in Spring." He said, "Check out his sense of orchestral colors."
Right.
I said, "Wow." I had to have Charlie Parker tell me to listen to Frederick Delius a little closer and listen to it and see what he did that was so amazing.
You could put those artists in column A and column B and no one would ever draw the lines, but that's a great story.
And Charlie Parker, like Dizzy and everyone else, loved Bartok.
Yeah, of course.
And I always did too. And Bartok had a lot of troubles because he had his own way of doing things and he didn't follow any group or change his music because he thought he had to. And I don't criticize people that did, because we all have to survive and feed our families.
Yeah.
But if you allow other people who don't know much about anything to tell you who and what you're supposed to be, most of the people who do know something will encourage you to be yourself and then improve yourself your whole life so that yourself can become a better person, but not to become a bad imitation of what someone says is the flavor of the month. Because I've found, especially being 87, that what is today's fashion usually ends up in tomorrow's landfill. And what's beautiful stays beautiful. And if it takes a while to get what you're doing appreciated, Moses was in the desert 40 years. So sometimes a time delay means you're right on schedule.
The last over 80-year-old composer we chatted with is the Argentinian-born Lalo Schifrin. He made his name big in Hollywood, composing scores to films and TV, with his best-known work coming from a short-lived but beloved spy thriller program, with a theme now due to reruns, but especially box office-busting movies, is known to everyone, anywhere in the world. He talked about its genesis, and then we'll hear it played by one of my guests this year, fellow Argentinian Miriam Conti.
Mission Impossible, I wrote a thing which is still called The Plot.
Right.
Because there are always plot, and I wrote a kind of march.
Mm-hmm.
4-4. Da da da.
Yes, I do.
Now, that was, let's say, for the pilot. I did the first show, and the network bought it and became a show.
Right.
Mission Impossible. But there was a problem. That march didn't make a signature. When people were listening, to the director was called by the network to tell the composer to write something like a signature.
Right.
So we need to put in the main title. And then credits a theme that could people are in the kitchen having a soft drink, and the television set is in the living room. They have to hear something. Say, "Oh, Mission Impossible!"
So your hook,
He asked me to write something like a signature. That was Mission Impossible. Was here now, but the plot also was very still because it was part of the action. You understand?
Yeah. No, I do. That once you said I composed this march, you started humming it. It immediately came to me that both of them appeared in all the segments, but the theme is the hook that everybody knew and would let you know that this could only be one thing. It could only be Mission Impossible.
We'll begin this 2019 on Cadenza exactly how we did last January, as we'll visit throughout the month with a group of composers whose music is important and who you should get to hear. I hope you'll be along with us. I'm going to leave you with music from a program that took us furthest afield in 2018, as I had a fun visit with George Hinchliffe, a founding member of the 35-year-old-plus Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. This is their live rendition of a tune, changing its familiar and catchy rhythm, but giving their own take on it, from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, the composer whose centenary we are still celebrating. This is their version, caught live in concert, of America. As I have said every week this year, I'm always glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer throughout the year by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.
Chromium steel in America. Wire spoke wheel. drive a Buick through San Juan. Cause I know a road that you can get on. Yours in America, knobs on the door.